Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Golf has always been at its most compelling when its greatest players are contemporaries. Nicklaus had Palmer, and to a lesser extent Trevino, Watson, and Player. On the rare occasions he's looked human, Woods has sparred with Els, Mickelson, Singh, and now Rory McIlroy. But three men born in 1912 are perhaps the best example of the magic that happens on the links when legendary players must face equally competitive and able rivals. Leading golf writer James Dodson explores the camaraderie and sometimes friction between some of golf's most influential figures who helped to put golf on the map as an American sport with homegrown heroes. Dodson's new book is American Triumvirate: Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and the Modern Age of Golf, which is published by Knopf. And as we look forward to the Masters, which teed off earlier this morning, we welcome James Dodson to the Roundtable. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Ian. Nice to be with you.
You've been around golf for so many years and writing about it. What led you to put these three together in a story that sort of encompasses everything they went through together and separately?
Good question. Well, let me start with the fact that I worked for Golf Magazine for almost 20 years. I was a columnist for 10 and wrote their tour profiles before that, 10 years before that. And I was American Express's golf editor for about 15 years as well, and was the senior writer at Yankee. I used to write golf for Yankee Magazine when I was their senior writer. So golf has always been part of my DNA. I was also Hogan's biographer. I wrote Arnold Palmer's memoirs, and then the Hogan estate asked me to work through this very big book on Ben Hogan. He was the most kind of mythic and unknown golfer. I mean, he was a very, very shy, very reticent. He was, some would have said, cold and forbidding figure, and I was kind of hesitant to do that after the Palmer book because I didn't think I was his kind of guy in terms of a good match. But it turned out to be great. I came to really admire Ben. I took 3.5 years on that book. It came out in 2005. And when I finished it, actually, I knew Sam Snead. I grew up in Greensboro where Snead had won a record eight times. And I knew Byron from years of writing about him for Golf Magazine and Departures Magazine. So I had done extensive interviews with both of them. Moreover, I had done a lot of early interviews with great players like Henry Pickard, who shaped all three careers, and the kind of other players from that golden age, which was a really interesting time in golf and sports in America. The 30s we're talking about primarily, and then the 40s. And I kind of had promised Sam, I always felt Sam and Byron, Ben was the kind of larger-than-life mythic figure because he survived the crash in 49. He came back and he won major championships. And I always felt like that Sam and Ben and Byron perhaps kind of got short shrift in a way from the media. They were kind of overshadowed, and yet Sam Snead was the winningest player ever in history. Byron Nelson had created at least a dozen records that nobody could beat for the longest time and still holds four or five of them, including the lowest stroke average, and of course the fact that in 1945 he won 18 tournaments in 1 year, 11 in a row. So I felt there was a much larger story, a more interesting story to be told. These were three guys all born in 1912, 100 years ago, the year the Fenway Park opened and the Titanic sank, and most of the American cities, major cities, got electric streetlights that year. General Electric introduced something called the electric washing machine that year. So it was a very much of a sea change year in America. And these guys came out of a rural American, the heartland, the poverty and dust, and certainly in the case of Ben and Byron, they grew up in small towns in Texas. Byron was the son of a Waxahachie cotton farmer who survived typhoid at 10 and gave his life to Christ and grew up to be a sunny, cheerful, upbeat young man who members of golf clubs always took a shine to. Ben, on the other hand, his father, who was a failed blacksmith, shot himself and probably in front of him when he was 9 years old, kind of casting Ben's life into the streets of South Fort Worth. Almost a Dickensian kind of ordeal, and he grew up kind of dark and suspicious and a runt, essentially, who had to fight his way into the caddy yard, same caddy yard where Byron Nelson played. Grew up to become a man who tried and failed three times to make it on the tour, finally broke through and won. And then you had Sam Snead, who was this character from the Blue Ridge Mountains, who was the youngest of six. His mother was 47 when he was born. He was really a wild child of the mountains who loved to fish and hunt and trap, and his whole sensibility was pretty much that of the outdoors. The first great athletic golfer, a five-star athlete in high school who could have played any number of sports. So each of them, in their own way, not only kind of rose to prominence in their own individual ways, but they not only kind of saved golf in the 30s, but they shaped the game in ways that are very commonplace and introduced practice and standards that are very commonplace on the tour today among the stars that you see this weekend at the Masters.
Just how unusual was it for the stars of golf to now be people who grew up in poverty, they were carrying caddy bags,
right, and
that was their first exposure to the game, to rise to the top of the game? Because I think golf, you know, even today, it has that stigma in some ways of being the country club game, but these guys really helped to dispel that early on, it seems.
Exactly, and here's why. Golf really was a rich man's game. When Wimette won at Brookline, and in the teens, and then all through the teens and the 20s, where you had Walter Hagen who came along, and he was the star, and Gene Sarazen was the star in the 20s, the roaring 20s. The economy was booming. Oil was king. Finance was roaring along. There were more country clubs opened than any other time at that time. And so suddenly, you know, things were really great. It was a true rich man's game. I mean, Vanity Fair, and I forget which major magazine, wrote that if you really wanted to become part of the elite, you had to play golf. That was one of their summer, spring issues. It was a rich man's game. Then it collapsed. When Bobby Jones left in 1930, he left the game after winning the Grand Slam. Golf, that was just after the crash of Wall Street, and not only did America go into its darkest decade, but so did golf. Probably something close to half of the current clubs in America either shut their doors for extended periods or went belly up, period. And the tour, which was really kind of a loose alliance of winner tournaments out in California and then across the Dixie, kind of really started to fall apart as well. The players were fighting. There were no superstars. There were no names that really held it together. Hagen was getting on. He would come out and play a few, certainly the major tournaments. Sarazen rarely showed up, sometimes showed up and then sometimes didn't. And, of course, Jones was gone. So there really wasn't a name, you know, to propel the game onto the top of the sports pages. Sam Snead comes out of nowhere in 1936, kind of a gee whiz country boy, Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of guy, who was dazzled this was in California, in Oakland. He won a tournament, and he was charming and funny and disarming and a bit of a hayseed. And he not only did a promoter from Boston named Fred Corcoran recognize that, and really kind of exploited it and put in. Suddenly Sam won two more tournaments, and then he won two more all in 1 year, and he was suddenly on the front page of the sports pages as this kind of charming, funny kid from the Republic of the Heartland who the public really took a shine to. They related to him. He was suspicious of the press, and he reportedly kept his money in a can in the backyard of his house in the mountains. You know, everything about Sam Snead fascinated people, and he had this gorgeous golf swing. So he really did it. And then Byron Nelson broke through and won the Masters in 1937 and then the Open in 1939, which Sam Snead blew. And the two of them, then Snead the next year, Hogan won in 1940. Just something to consider. Between 1940, when Ben won, and about 1953, when he basically retired, had his great year and finished the game and more or less retired to start an equipment company, one of the three of them was either first, second, or third about 65% of the time.
Amazing.
Byron Nelson in 1945 won 18 tournaments, 11 in a row at one point. It's just an extraordinary accomplishment. There's no period in any sports that I know of, and I've asked several people, that's really comparable that kind of domination.
Did, at the time, they recognize the sort of the specialness of their accomplishments? And just to add to that question, how did they view each other and treat each other?
Well, they're good questions. To answer your first question, I think they did. They realized that they had struggled so long and hard, all of them. You got to remember that there was no money in professional golf then. If you placed in the first three or four spots, you might make enough to continue to the next week. So and most of the tournaments were kind of little swayback towns across the fruited plain that major railroads didn't go to. So they drove in cars, they hitchhiked, they rode, they hitched rides with other people. So it was a real vagabond's life. A lot of them were hustlers. They were hustling up games on the sides. Paul Runyon, who's a wonderful player and a great veteran and really helped me with this book. He's dead now. He's been dead about 10 years, but he talked a lot. He told me a ton about Sam and Byron and the rest of them and what they were up against. I think of Hogan as the Seabiscuit of golfers. And Snead was this kind of, like Joe DiMaggio, this kind of glamour guy who never really wanted to be a glamour guy, but could be either as smooth as a Spanish diplomat and charming and funny or as vulgar and difficult as could be. In fact, Bobby Jones and the guys at Augusta didn't particularly care for Snead because he always had a woman on his arm like Walter Hagen, and not always his wife, and he was hilariously funny at times, and he was very crude at times.
And he didn't seem to outgrow that either.
No, he didn't, and he did it on purpose. And what I explore some in this book is the psychologies of the three different men, which is just remarkable to me. You could not have had three more different men. They were actually friends. Of course, Byron and Ben came out of the same caddy yard, and Byron, who achieved success earlier, really did help Ben along, gave him his first driver that he won with, helped him, helped finance him, gave him, you know, they traveled together there with their wives early on in the tour. Sam became friends with them after they were established on tour, but I think Ben and Sam probably had, at the end of the day, the closer relationship as rivals, because when Byron left the game, he, you know, Ben and Byron really did, had very little to do with each other, even though they lived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You know, that's why this book, I chose to start it with 1954, the Masters of 1954, when Billy Joe Patton, this kind of genial, funny, wisecracking country boy from the mountains of North Carolina, almost won the Masters as an amateur. And that year that he showed up there as a special invitee was the last time Snead, Hogan, and Nelson, one of them would win a major championship. Each of them came to Augusta that year with two Masters titles, and only one left with it, and that was Sam. He beat Ben in a playoff. And Billy Joe missed making that playoff by one stroke. So it's a really wonderful moment. That year, 1954, a young Pennsylvanian with this sort of slashing corkscrew swing named Arnold Palmer won the U.S. Amateur and really began to sort of light up scoreboards and change the whole nature of American golf. So it really was a great year, an amazing year, and it was the beginning of really the modern tour, I think, as we know it.
Now it's the 2012 Masters, 100 years since these three men were born, all eyes turning to Augusta, that yearly spring ritual. What do you see happening this weekend, and just how good are the players in stacking up with the legacies you've written about here?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, obviously, I think that Augusta is such a special place because it never changes. It's forever in our minds because we've watched it for so long, and so many of us have been there, and it stays the same. That's part of its beauty. And it is beautiful. It's the rite of spring, and it's kind of the rebirth of the game every year. So that's pretty special. And I would tell you, these guys really are responsible, in my mind, for putting the Masters on the map. Their successes created the biggest crowds and galleries since the days of Bobby Jones. And it really did. They all three worshipped the winning the Masters. Byron's widow, Peggy, still wears the medallion of he won at the Masters in 1937, which he considered his greatest win. Today, it's much more of a corporate game. It's more of an industry, a business with so many of these guys today. You got to remember the earlier days; they were fighting for survival. They were just wanting to eat for the most part, and they loved the game, and it was, you know, part of their makeup. But today, I think the tour is a very different place. I don't doubt that they want to win as intensely. Obviously, the comeback of Tiger last week and winning at Bay Hill in his backyard, of course, he knows like the back of his hand. Was very, very useful to Tiger. I'm not sure Tiger's completely back. He's, and one of the differences is with him on the sidelines is there's a whole generation of these young golfers who are hit the ball farther and are not at all intimidated by Tiger Woods. That's a difference than in just the past 3 or 4 years. You know, I know a lot of people are very excited and already Tiger's the odds-on favorite to win. I don't think he will. Then again, I'm sort of I'm an unapologetic fan of. My heroes were Arnold Palmer and Sam Snead in that order. I think it's going to be very exciting. I look at a kid like Webb Simpson and Rory McIlroy and some of these young players. They exhibit a quality that you can see in those older players. They have a joy of playing, and they're grateful to be there, and they have a lot of passion. So it's really kind of fun to watch.
And let's not forget that Woods is trying to compete at the same level he laid out for himself years beyond where maybe Nelson retired at 34.
Great point and absolutely true. Situation. Look at the great superstars. Most have about a 7-year run, 8-year run. Well, Tiger's been up there about 11 or 12 years, and he's 35 years old, I think, almost, if he isn't already. That's the year Byron Nelson retired. And it's very rare to find a player who can play at that level after that long. And certainly the great players, you know, if he does it, it'll be truly one for the ages, and he certainly has the skills. My question about Tiger would be the mindset of golf is so important, especially with majors. And I just don't know. I think a lot has been sacrificed to his challenges in the past few years, and it remains to be seen. Meanwhile, I think there's a number of these young players who just are born to the hunt. They seem perfectly natural out there, and they're really fun to watch. And I think they've made golf really fun again to watch. When you consider that Phil Mickelson's now the old man of the crowd, that's pretty interesting.
We've been speaking with James Dodson. His book is American Triumvirate: Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and the Modern Age of Golf. It's been a real pleasure to read the book and to talk about it with you, and I appreciate your time today.
Dan, my pleasure. Love your radio station, and it's a great pleasure to be with you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.